This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we talk with the great cinematographer Gordon Willis. Here are scenes from a few of his classic films.
What have I ever done to make you treat me so disrespectfully? If you'd come to me in friendship, then the scum that ruined your daughter would be suffering this very day. And if by chance an honest man like yourself should make enemies, then he would become my enemies. And then they would fear you.
Mitchell was in control.
Wait a minute.
There were men working under Mitchell.
How many?
I don't know how many, but the men working under Mitchell were the ones that received the money from the slush fund.
Okay, do we know how much money we're talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. And these men are the key to what that money was used for. Boy, that woman was paranoid. At one point, I suddenly wondered how high up this thing goes, and her paranoia finally got to me. I thought what we had was so hot that any minute CBS or NBC are going to come in through the windows and take the story.
You're both paranoid. She's afraid of John Mitchell, and you're afraid of Walter Cronkite.
Right.
Can we go back to what?
Hi. Hi.
Oh, hi. Hi.
Well, bye.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
In sequence, we heard Marlon Brando in The Godfather, Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford in All the President's Men, and Woody Allen and Diane Keaton in Annie Hall, three films on which Gordon Willis served as cinematographer. He shot 8 Woody Allen movies, including Manhattan, Broadway Danny Rose, and Zelig, and The Godfather Trilogy. His other films include Clute, The Parallax View, and Pennies from Heaven. This weekend, Willis will give a master class at the American Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, New York. We invited Willis to talk with us about some of his films, starting with The Godfather, which was released in 1972. I asked him about the guiding principles behind the look of the film.
You know, for a while, I really didn't know what to do with that movie. You know, I thought about it for weeks, and I finally decided, I thought, this should be have this kind of brassy yellow look to it. Don't ask me why. It just felt right, you know. So that was the first thing that I applied in my thinking. And the other part of the thinking was I should have this kind of New York street look, one foot in the gutter, 40s kind of feeling, a little dirty. And so I was satisfied with that kind of feeling in my mind. And then the other thing is, well, I thought, you know, we didn't get the money to go to Sicily until about 2/3 of the way through the movie when the Paramount people realized that they had something better than a cheap crime novel on their hands. So they gave us the money to go to Sicily. So I figured at that point, Sicily should look, you know, mythical and sunny and kind of storybook feeling. So that there was a juxtaposition between these two places, New York and Sicily, and there was a counterpoint when we went back and forth.
Let me ask you about one of the kind of most famous scenes in the first Godfather movie, and that's right. When the studio executive, who isn't playing ball with the Corleone family,
right,
wakes up in his silk sheets and his satin and his satin cover to find that his bed is basically flooded with blood because the decapitated head of his horse is underneath the covers. Can you talk about shooting that scene?
It was very hot that day. It was kind of smelly. I think for animal lovers, you have to know that this was a real horse's head, by the way. But it was a horse that had already died and one that was, pardon me, in the glue factory already. So they acquired the horse and kept it on ice, and you know, we put it in bed, and when we were ready, after we were through lighting, etc., and off we went. But as I said, I prefaced it by saying it was hot that day, so once you took this horse out of the ice, it got a little gamey. So it was kind of the last thing we did. But it was real horse.
And what were your concerns as the cinematographer of that scene?
Well, my concern always is just getting it right. I mean, you know, getting the visualization of the moment getting that right. That's always my concern.
What did getting it right mean in this situation where a guy is kind of waking up out of a dream, senses something's wrong, and then realizes this absolutely horrible thing has happened, this absolutely horrible thing is happening in his bed, and he's just like screaming?
Well, from my point of view, getting it right means seeing it at the level that you should see it from an audience point of view, perceiving it properly, visually. That's all I have to come up with at that point.
What are some of the changes you made between the first Godfather and Godfather 2 in terms of, for instance, how you shot the interiors? Because Godfather 2, it's a different decade. It's a different generation.
Right. Well, one of the things you have to do, or one of the things that I decided to do, was that since these are sister movies and that they really work together in a sense, is that I maintained this same color structure in the second Godfather. It was this yellow, kind of yellow that went. However, the content of the structure of the photography I changed because of this turn of the century feeling and the retrospective footage. And then we went from, 1902 up to 1950-something in Lake Tahoe. So
what were some of the differences between the flashback sequences, the turn-of-the-century sequences with De Niro, and the current sequences with Pacino?
Well, I guess, that's all in my head, more or less. But the way I can give you a quick example of it is we... our only reference to those of us who are living at this point to what was going on in 1902 or late 1800s are photographs of the period. So you sort of take that as a resource. But you have to go a little bit further in order to make it work. So it was that kind of structure. And you don't have the same kind of clarity in the photography. It's more ethereal in a way. And when we get to Sicily in the same movie, it becomes, more mythic and more beautiful. So it was tricky because you had New York, then you had Sicily, which had to be different, but still in the same time period. And then, you had Lake Tahoe in the 50s. So when you have an audience watching this kind of film, you don't want to push too much visual information at too many different levels. You want to be able to They should be able to watch the movie, take it in, know they're in a different place, and be able to accept that without getting in the way of telling the story. I mean, at one point, Francis said to me, how are we going to know where we are here? We're going from here to there to there to here. I said, look, when we get to New York, and you say, New York, 19 so-so. When you get to Tennessee, put a one-liner under it. I said, it's been done for years. It's classy. Everybody will know where they are, and there won't be a problem. So there were presentation of a story that was that long and that complex. You want to present simply, because the simple is the most elegant,
What were the streets in New York, or the parts of New York, that were easiest to transform convincingly to the turn of the century?
Jesus, none of them. It was, we were downtown in the Lower East Side, and what happened was we had one east to west block, which the art department, Dean Tavolaris, who did a great job, it changed. Changed means, you redo everything. You redo all the storefronts, the buildings, and the buildings, for the most part, the superstructure of the building were about the same, but all the storefronts and everything had to be put back in time. So it was very complex. And then, of course, you see past that into more contemporary streets at the very end, which I had to block out with big tarps and things that became sort of transfused into the visual. You couldn't see them. It was tough.
We had to put tarps over whole buildings?
I put tarps over whole buildings, not based on what I just said, but I'd hang them like two blocks away so you couldn't see down. But I had to tarp one whole side of the street. people were yelling at us. We pulled tarps right up in front of the windows. But because the sun would hit that side of the street, that side of the building and bounce into the street, and we couldn't do that. You know, we had to have continuity in the visual structure. So there were two reasons for tarps: one to kill sun, and one so you couldn't see across town.
My guest is cinematographer Gordon Willis. He shot the Godfather trilogy, All the President's Men, and 8 Woody Allen movies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is cinematographer Gordon Willis. He shot the 3 Godfather movies. He shot 8 Woody Allen movies, including Annie Hall in Manhattan and All the President's Men. In the Godfather films, there are so many great actors, different generations of great actors, different types of acting styles. You've got De Niro, Pacino, Brando, Lee Strasberg. Was there anything that had to change in your approach to shooting them because of their different approaches to acting? Or for example, was one of them the kind who wanted to do a scene over and over again, and another the kind of actor who believes first take is best take?
Yeah, you've always got a certain amount of that while you're working. Regarding the structure of the movie, they had to do what we laid out, and you sort of work in concert to make sure everybody's comfortable, but that's the design of the movie. As far as the way they function, Al would like to do things in a certain way, and definitive actor was Lee Strasberg. He had no problems doing it, and doing it well, and not doing it a whole lot, Marlon Brando didn't like to do a lot of takes either. I don't remember being particularly indulgent, wanting to do too many, but, it depends on how secure an actor is within the structure of the scene and the material, how far he wants to go with it. I think Bobby De Niro was kind of the most method actor in the group, and Bob would take a while to get to the place that he thought was good, almost to the point it'd drive you crazy, how to pick up an apple, 25 minutes later, he's still trying to pick it up 3-4 different ways. Francis said, just pick the apple up and eat it. Everybody has their own way in, finally, if it works, that's all that matters.
I'm sure you realize that, when Brando was in The Godfather, everybody would be studying him to see, what did he look like? How had he changed? What's his acting like now?
So
how did that affect how you shot him, knowing that he had a look, pretty iconic in this movie, that he was a much older man than people remembered, and that he was no longer going to be like the kind of sex icon that he was?
Of course, all that worked in our favor because just to recap this business about asking about photography on the first movie, the thing that happened that had to happen was Marlon said, I have this idea, about this makeup and everything. He says, but, it has to be photographed. I said, sure, I know. So we shot these tests, those tests are available on some of the re-releases of Godfather and DVD. So we went into the studio, and he stuffs the stuff in his mouth, and he puts on a few things, make a long story short, I had to design the lighting so that Marlon looked right in the movie, when you first see him in the office and when you see him in the rest of the movie. And the design of that lighting had to work for Marlon, but it also had to be able to take it in through the rest of the movie to be able to apply it everywhere. So actually it was him and his makeup and his look that actually were responsible for the designing the overall look of the lighting, which was not only carried through one, but was carried through two as well.
So what was it that you needed to do lighting-wise to get his look right?
The bottom line of it is it all had to be overhead lighting because, there were two things. I didn't really want to see his eyes that well, although I was criticized for it, because I didn't want anybody to say, he didn't want to quite know what he was thinking all the time, And in order to make the makeup work, we had to have this sort of overhead lighting to give him this look that he had. And, of course, everybody else had to have, selectively, had to be subjected to the same kind of lighting to make the movie hold together visually.
There's this great operatic sequence in Godfather 1 that intercuts between a baptismal scene in a church and these Corleone mob murders. Mm. And can you talk a little bit about the kind of shooting that you did to give it that operatic look?
What happened was, it was Francis's idea to use this counterpoint of taking this baby, this child, in the environment of a church, and the dialogue that went with it, denouncing the devil, etc., and at the same time putting the counterpoint of killing everybody against that image. So that idea in itself sort of holds the whole thing together. So it's the idea, it's the counterpoint that makes this so strong, of a baby renouncing the devil and a baby being christened in the middle of the church, and then the counterpoint of all these people being murdered. So it wouldn't mean much. A lot of people have tried to do that in movies since, by the way, one form or another. But
I noticed.
Yeah, it wouldn't. Yeah. But it wouldn't mean much if you, you know, finished that scene, got in a car and drove away, and then started the other stuff. So what means something is the counterpoint of it, you know, of Richie Castellano shooting somebody in an elevator, and then somebody machining somebody else in bed, and then somebody getting shot. It's I don't want to use the word fun, but it's fun to watch that kind of structure. It's definitive and it works. You know.
Let's talk about working on Woody Allen's movies. Manhattan is shot in black and white. Right. Was that your idea or Woody Allen's idea?
Well, actually, it was Woody's idea because he loves black and white. So do I.
Why do you love black and white?
I don't know. I look at New York. It's kind of a black and white city to me. It's, you know, when you work in color, it's a burden. It can be a burden to an audience if you don't use it properly, and it's a burden to the people who are working with it, because if you don't make the right choices in color, you don't make the right choices in clothes, you don't make the right choices, you know, then it all comes together, it looks good. Whereas in black and white, you're really working in values, you know, grays, blacks and white. So actually the visual structure in a black and white movie can become more difficult in one sense, because you have to pay attention to values, you know, separating people from backgrounds, et cetera, et cetera. And I just find the content in a black and white movie sometimes can be a lot easier to watch, because you don't have this kind of color thing going on, you know.
Did Woody Allen ask you to go back and watch a lot of Ingmar Bergman movies before working with him? Because Woody Allen's such a Bergman fan, and there's so many Bergman references in his films.
Right. No, he never asked me to watch anything. All of his movies are designed from the ground up. I mean, I must say that working with Woody for 10 years was like a vacation. I mean, I had so much fun. And I think I probably like Woody a lot more than he likes me, because I'm kind of a carnivore when I'm making movies. You know, I want to get it done. I want to get it done the right way, and I don't, you know, want to fool around. But from the standpoint of working with a man who's, you know, it's like working with your hands in your pockets when you're working with Woody. It's a very easy, off-the-cuff kind of day. And I don't mean that we don't plan. We do. And the movies are designed to look like they're off the cuff, but they're not. But it's just working with him as a personality was a pleasure. And I also like working with writers. I mean, because if something's not working, you know, you take the pencil, you cross it out, and throw the page away, and you do something else. You know, it's much faster than working with a director who can't write, who has to get on the phone and talk to the, you know, thing. This way, you know, it's right there. So he tears it out, and then you start again. You know, it's quick.
Cinematographer Gordon Willis. This weekend, he'll give a masterclass at the American Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, Queens, as part of their second annual masterclass series. Willis will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with cinematographer Gordon Willis. He shot The Godfather Trilogy, All the President's Men, and 8 Woody Allen movies, including Annie Hall and Manhattan. Willis grew up in New York City. Now, your father was in the movie business when you were growing up. He was a makeup man?
Yeah, he was a makeup artist at Warner's, the old Warner's lot in Brooklyn at that time during the Depression.
And so what kind of work did he do? He made up the stars?
Makeup actors and things. At that time, Warner's on the East Coast, you know, they were doing a lot of shorts. Remember those in movies, shorts?
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of things like that. So he was there, and I used to go to work with him a lot and take me out to the studio.
Since your father was a makeup artist, I'm wondering what his attitude toward glamour was. Did he think of it as something synthetic that was created by artists like him, or did he think of it as being something that certain actors intrinsically had?
That's a good question. I think he felt it was intrinsic to the actor, but, you know, again, makeup was a tool, and you put it on and the best way you know how to help the actor.
In earlier Hollywood eras, such as the era your father worked, glamorous stars were supposed to go to bed with their makeup, survive attacks without their makeup, you know, without their lipstick getting smeared or the mascara running.
Right.
And I think in some ways we've gone past that. Not in all movies, but what was your approach to makeup? Were there things about makeup you wanted to rethink when you started making movies?
Yeah, I always look at makeup as like Bondo, you know, stuff to use on camera. I mean, I like take it all off, okay? Just no makeup on men unless, you know, they've got a problem. A problem meaning they've got to cover blemishes or they need a little bit of this or that. That's fine. But, you know, when somebody goes in with a spray gun and puts on the makeup for the day, I don't know how many people I've sent back because men, mostly men, that have had just take it all off. You know, it doesn't look good. And there are some women that wear too much as well. But you take the eye makeup off a lot of famous actresses, and you won't know who they are. I mean, a lot of it happens in their eyes. But generally speaking, I like minimum amount of makeup on people, you know. A natural look, let me put it that way. It looks a lot better on the screen, in my opinion. I mean, a lot of actresses become panicky when you say, you know, well, look, why don't we just take some of this off? You know, it's like you're asking you to take the clothes off. No, just take some of the lipstick off. It's too, you know. And sometimes you make a mistake. You say, take that off. They take it off, and they don't look good. You know, you say, I'm sorry, put it back on again. You know, but it's generally less is better than more.
How do you say, oh, I'm sorry, better put that lipstick back on without making them feel real bad?
Well, no, because, you know, it's kind of, you're sort of all in the same deal there. I mean, you want to be, I'm not very political, actually, but I am when I'm talking to certain actors and to certain women who are actresses. But you're all on the same boat. You know, everybody's trying to get it right.
Right.
I mean, she'll say, I've had actresses come up to me, one of which I think is a brilliant actress, and she's never been a movie star, but she's a great actress. I mean, she came up to me in the middle of a movie, and she said, they usually have a set of stills in their hand that the still man has been taking. Well, a set of stills don't represent what you're doing. It's because they're at the wrong angle, I can't really see. But they have the set of stills, and she's saying, listen, you know, you see all this stuff under my neck here? She said, I said, you don't have that. I said, you can't see it on the screen. I said, you look wonderful, actually, on the screen. And she said, I'm so frightened. She says, you know, I'm getting up there. And you know what they do to women in Hollywood when they get to be 40? I said, don't worry, it's not going to happen. You look great. But there's a lot going on, you know, in older actresses as well as younger actresses. But mostly, when you know, you begin to put on a few miles, you begin to worry. So you want a lot of war paint on, you want to look good, you know.
Right.
So you have to understand that when you're discussing these things with actresses especially.
Now, a lot of actresses now, and I guess actors too, have face work because there's so much pressure to look young and to not have wrinkles. Can you kind of see that behind the camera? Do you feel that there's any differences you could see in the face that's had that kind of work?
Yeah, well, I've never really felt that plastic surgery is that successful for someone who's been working in a certain way all their lives, and then they suddenly decide they want to sand down their entire face and make it look better. It always looks like you've got this huge clip holding their face back, you know, in the back of their head, you can't see it. But I find it's generally doesn't work. It's one thing to have just, you know, someone had a nose job when they were 20 and now they're 40 and it still looks great, that kind of thing, or a few wrinkles. But when anybody starts, you know, putting on a new head with new ears and new, it doesn't really, you can see it. I mean, it's not great.
When you've had more than one facelifts, the face gets so taut that you can't make regular expressions. Or also, if you're using Botox, which paralyzes some of the facial muscles, you can't have a fully expressive face. Have you come across that?
No, I've never. Yeah, the Bondo look. No, I've never really been faced with the stainless steel actress face look. It's kind of sad to look at. I've seen personalities that I haven't dealt with, but I look at them and I think this was a beautiful girl 10 minutes ago. I don't know why she decided to rearrange herself.
My guest is cinematographer Gordon Willis. He shot all three Godfather films. He shot 8 Woody Allen films, including Annie Hall in Manhattan and All the President's Men. Yeah. You've photographed Manhattan so much for Woody Allen's films and for the Godfather movies. Mm. Just wondering, you know, if you could share any of your personal thoughts about Ground Zero in Manhattan.
Well, you know, I've thought of the times that I photographed this building with people in front of it and skylines that I've photographed with this thing, and it made me so sad. And it's hard for me to look at those pictures now in retrospect because I sadden a lot of people, but I've got this very, very good library of these great shots that I've made of people in front of these two buildings. I haven't gone down. I have to go into New York next week, but I haven't gone downtown since it happened. I will. But I find it very disturbing still.
You live in Cape Cod now, which is known, right, among other things, for its beautiful light.
Right.
Is that something that means a lot to you?
Yeah, it means a lot to me, not so much from the standpoint that, I want to rip out a camera. Light means a lot to me in life. You know, I mean, I hate to be in rooms that don't have dimension and beautiful light. And I have the same feeling about living in a place that doesn't have dimension and beautiful light. I mean, I hate Los Angeles. It's like living inside a toaster oven, you know. It's awful. The light stinks. The only time I like it there is really in winter when it's a little bit better. But I love New York light in the winter. Winter light is so beautiful. It's beautiful here in the winter.
Can you describe New York light?
I can describe New York light mostly in the winter because it's like, it's like my favorite thing. You move from light to dark. You know, you move from a brilliant splash of sun to kind of like a midnight shadow, you know, and you watch the sun come up in the east and go down in the west in New York, and it's like, you know, it looks like welding sometimes. It's so beautiful. It's stunning, mainly because it's moving through all of these buildings, you know, and it bounces through windows and off windows and down into the street. It's always changing, which is quite wonderful. Unless you happen to be photographing something, then you want to hurry up so you get it the right way. But it's just as stunning.
Cinematographer Gordon Willis. He'll give a master class this weekend at the American Museum of the Moving Image in Astoria, New York. 3 other cinematographers, including Conrad Hall and Ed Lachman, will also give master classes there this month. This is Fresh Air.